Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 12th of May, 2021, and this is David Taylor and Phil Bishop with Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm doing well, David. How are things at your end?
Yeah, pretty good, I suppose, for a Wednesday morning.
You're looking forward to hugging people?
I was going to ask you the same question. No, I'm not looking forward to it, actually. I think that some people might take a liberty or two and start hugging everybody in sight because I haven't done it for over a year. So I'm going to steer clear of people that I'm not intimately acquainted with already.
And we'll also be allowed to sit inside restaurants, bars and pubs next week. That's the other big breakthrough. And cinemas are opening, I think, aren't they, next week as well?
Oh, I didn't know that, but my pub seems to have closed down in the last week. Every time I walk past it, it seems to be closed. Well, maybe they're just making lots of preparations for the big opening on Monday, I don't know. Well, it's a step towards normality again, I suppose, so I'm looking forward to that, certainly.
All the numbers suggest that the construction industry has already bounced free of COVID and charging back. The report out this morning, the Office for National Statistics had, 8.5% growth in March or something? No, 5.8%.
Yes. Yeah, not bad at all.
But all good, all good. And, other figures, other surveys, which April Purchasing Managers Index was very, very strong again. So construction is looking set fair. The only problems are is that cost inflation is raising its head. Material prices are going up and shortages and skills shortages. So in the midst of all the good news, you can trust the construction industry to find some gloom. But we'll brush over the gloom and focus on the good, shall we?
Yeah. Well, I suppose the biggest event of the week so far has been the Queen's speech, hasn't it? Which is everybody was looking forward to. I had an absolute deluge of press releases from every industry organisation you can think of giving us their appraisal of it. What did you make of it, Phil? Did you think there was anything in there which surprised you at all?
I don't think there's anything that particularly surprised. Well, OK, there was one thing that surprised me. It's not at all related to construction, which I think is frankly outrageous, that you're going to have to take your driving licence or your passport or some other photo ID to be allowed to vote at the next elections. Which, OK, I've got a passport and a driving licence, no problem for me, but not everyone has and not everyone has to.
It's funny, isn't it?
It seems to be a calculated way to disenfranchise people who are unlikely to vote Tory anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. People in this country, I think I've mentioned this before, we're very strongly averse to the idea of having to carry mandatory ID around with us like they do in so many other countries. You know, most of us do. Most of us have our driving license in our wallet or something like that. We don't normally walk around with our passports. But the very idea of being compelled to carry identification with you so that you can be stopped and quizzed at any particular moment is anathema to most British people. So I'm surprised that they've decided to introduce that. And I also think that it's totally unnecessary, quite honestly.
Anyway, but more specifically, going back to the elements more closely related to construction industry interests, there was a lot there. Was I surprised by anything? Not hugely, I will be honest, because these are things that have been in the manifesto, they've been in the works and the pipeline for a number of years, some of them. And in many cases, there are things which we had been expecting a year or more ago, but everything government basically was put on hold by the damn pox, by COVID. And so a lot of legislation, I'm thinking here of the post-Grenfell, you know, Judith Hackett recommendations for building safety reforms and so on. I think they were ready to go a year ago. And so things like that are all great. Interesting take in the Times this morning, I noticed, where they give a controversy rating to various bits of the proposed legislation. Planning, 5-star controversy rating.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
No, but they're building safety happily. I can't remember if it was two or even a one star controversy rating. In other words, it's they gave two. I don't know how they get two. I'm sure it's only one star. Maybe it doesn't go far enough, some people might say. But the building safety bill, I think, is a welcome and fairly straightforward thing. We'll have big implications, and we've spoken about that before.
What about the planning? The planning reforms. What are people complaining about there?
The people complaining about it tend to be people who are stand open to be accused of NIMBYs. Alternatively, they would say that they want to preserve the beauty of the British countryside, etc. And there is a democratic argument that once the local authorities, planning authorities, have set these zones, one of three zones, build, maybe build, and don't build, basically, that developers then just go, right, okay, we can do what we want here now, move in. And there's very little scope for local people to sort of go, excuse me, we're not sure we quite like this idea. Tough, too late, it's assumed to go ahead.
Is there any mechanism by which once a scheme has got approval, say it's somebody proposes a housing development in an area which the local authority has already deemed suitable for development, once that, presumably that is then just waved through because it's been sort of pre-qualified, if you like. But is there then a mechanism for people to raise objections to the specific development proposed for that site? Because, of course, that's presumably, you know, that people will want to do that, won't they? Once they know what's going to be built there, some people will have objections to it quite naturally. So is there a mechanism?
My understanding is that in those areas that have been designated for building, for development, I'm not sure there is. Happy to be corrected on this point. However, it won't be possible just to put up corrugated iron sheds all over the place. I mean, this is all coupled with the building better, building beautiful, that report thing, where the local authorities will be able to or be expected to set out design codes and guidance on to try and prevent the prevalence of boxes and rabbit hutches and so on. But it's not about, the whole thrust of the planning bill is not about making the countryside better, prettier, or even, you know, ensuring that the infrastructure's going in there along with the housing. The whole thrust of it is to get more houses built so that more people can own their own home, is what it's all about. So we need cheap homes that people can afford. Of course, the flip side of that is more homes means that the people who've got a home will see their value not rise as it has been doing, or even down. So there's always this conflict and tension, of course, between, you know, every action's got an equal and opposite reaction.
Okay. So there was the planning bill. There are other elements as well, weren't there? The one which caught my eye was the High Speed 2, which, as you know, is not my most favourite scheme. HS2 Phase 2, the Crewe to Manchester arm. And I know I'm not alone in noticing that there's no mention of Leeds, because Phase 2, I think, is actually the fork in the Y, isn't it, on HS2?
Yes.
You've got Crewe, well, actually Birmingham to Manchester going up on to the west, and then you've got Birmingham through to Leeds and I think York as well, on the eastern side. There's no mention of that bit, which is actually the longest bit of Phase 2. And the government doesn't seem to have explained why that's not mentioned, although a lot of people have pointed out that it has been, you know, it's prominently absent, put it that way.
Personally, as a West Yorkshire person, North Yorkshire person, I'm concerned by that. I would very much like to see the Leeds leg go ahead. And I'm not sure. I haven't followed that one up with the people who know about these things. No. I think we'll just have to wait and see what they say about Leeds. But it could fall. Well, the whole thing could still, you know, Manchester bit could still fall down with the changing mood and the changing economy and changing travel patterns and so on. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
Maybe the government just didn't want to overreach and try and push through too much. Maybe it thinks that if it, you know, does a little and often, then maybe it can sort of deliver the thing with less controversy, rather than saying, right, we're going to build two great big rail links, one up the west side, one up the east side, and upset twice as many people. So, yeah, I think that's quite interesting. What else was there? The procurement bill was another one which I noticed.
Yes, again, this has a low controversy rating from the Times. Let's see what the
They
said that.
Oh, I'm surprised.
Yeah, one star. This is even less controversial, according to the Times, even less controversial than the building safety bill. Two elements of this, really. One is it's now we're not subject to EU directives, where everything mm-hmm. of a certain value has to be put out to tender to all EU suppliers. The government talks about it as tidying up lots and lots of little European regulations, or big European regulations, but all sorts of them, into a much simpler UK package. I bet it ain't any more simple. It never is, but it's reforming it. You know, it's removing all the EU requirements and putting much the same requirements into a UK context. But the one that the construction industry is very much aligned to, has become aligned to, we've talked about in the past, is the concept of social value, whereby public clients will be able to specify that in the contract that contractors won't just have to put up building X with such and such specification, it'll also have to create, I don't know, so many jobs, or demonstrate that it's going to do other things beyond the scope of the contract itself. Now, this all reminds me, I think, again, we might have talked about this in the past, this all reminds me in the 1980s when the Tory government then took again Labour-run, particularly the GLC, but Labour-run local authorities engaging in something called contract compliance. You can have this, mm-hmm. you know, you can only have this contract if you, and there are various aspects of it, have a certain percentage of, minority representation in your workforce, and contract compliance is all about putting social political goals embedded into contract terms. And you know, Nicholas Ridley and Margaret Thatcher and Norman Tebbit and that generation of Tory fought this and got rid of this and outlawed that, and that was dreadful. And it just shows how far the Conservative government has moved from the days of Thatcher, where they're nationalising things and handing out aid left, right and centre to individuals and companies. And now it's the whole social value movement, it seems to me, is it's not exactly contract compliance, but it's son of contract compliance. And I can well imagine another government would just move it forward that a little bit more, and it would become the return of contract compliance, which was such a controversial issue in the 1980s.
Well, I suppose do you remember corporate social responsibility, which is a phrase you don't really hear very often these days because it's been superseded by
social value, yes.
Yeah, by social value, exactly. But it's all part of the same move in that direction, isn't it? You know, people, I suppose about 10, 15 years ago, all you ever heard about was CSR, and everybody was anxious to wave the CSR banner and show how inclusive they were. Well, that no longer cuts any ice, because we're all there now. You know, it's, as you say, social value is virtually a sort of a mainstream element of procurement, isn't it? It's embedded now.
It's how you win the job. Basically, it's taken for granted that you can do the job, and you can put price still becomes part of it, but I don't think price is a distinguisher anymore. You might be an outlier at the top and the bottom who you chuck out straight away as being far too expensive, far too stupidly cheap, it's all about social value. And we said before, every announcement that big contractors put out about how they've won this contract, then they're not bragging about how cleverly they've designed this bridge or tall building and how they're going to build it in such a really clever way with beautiful design or beautiful engineering. It's about, yeah, we're going to build a building, but more importantly, we're going to take on three apprentices and we're going to do lots of school presentations and this, that and the other, which has technically got nothing. It's got nothing directly to do with the building itself, but that's what won them the job.
Yeah, absolutely. It was something in the language when the procurement bill was announced and the way it was reported, I think, by a lot of publications, not least ourselves, I think, actually, summarised as the idea of the procurement bill was to make it easier for public bodies to give contracts to preferred suppliers. And I thought in the current climate, that perhaps wasn't the best choice of phrase, because, I mean, we're talking about David Cameron and Greensill Capital and procurement of PPE during the COVID crisis. Making it easier for public bodies to give contracts to preferred suppliers isn't exactly what a lot of people are looking for.
Okay, hands up. That was my slant. That was my...
Well, I know. That's why I picked it up. But you weren't the only one who saw it in those terms. And it's a fair summary, isn't it?
The point being with any procurement, and again, just we talked about in planning, every action has an equal opposite reaction. The more you try and simplify things... the more you risk opening the door for, let's not mince words, corruption. The more it becomes easier for whether it's a buyer or local politicians or local government managers or not just local government, national government, public sector of any kind. Mm-hmm. If you are not expected to justify how and why you've reached that decision, and somehow if you're buying purely on price, you can say these were the bids, that's the lowest price, that's the lowest bid, fact, they get the job. Clearly the buyer has done their duty, their fiduciary duty with public money, and spending as little as possible to get the job done, as long as it meets the spec. The whole thing of bringing in social values we've talked about before is that there are... It's an emerging social science, a bit like economics. I mean, there are ways of measuring these things, but there's no absolute rigid standard to say bid A is better than bid B because of these social value metrics. And therefore, because of that, there is scope for someone to say, hang on a sec, why did company A get that job instead of company B? Yeah. Are you members of the same golf club? Mm-hmm. Grey areas. The scope for grey areas come in. And I suppose it will require the bill will be obviously be drafted very carefully, but it will be the committee process that will have to... The bill will go through the House of Lords and the House of Commons and committees there. And they will have to ask all of these questions to make sure that probity is absolutely embedded in the process.
What else was there in the Queen's speech which caught your eye, Phil? There was something about training, wasn't there, and lifetime skills, that kind of thing. I've seen some positive response to that from the industry.
Yes, I haven't read the details of that, I confess, but I'm aware that certainly I've read responses and reactions. Essentially, the aspiration, the aim, is to make it easier for, I suppose, again, the current post-COVID environment where... Are we allowed to talk about post-COVID? Are we in the post-COVID environment yet? Almost.
We will be on Monday.
Back end of the COVID environment, hopefully. I mean, there's still next winter to come. There could be another wave and clampdown and whatever. But in the current situation in which we find ourselves...
okay, that's fair. That's... we can have you for that.
A lot of people have had, particularly people of a certain age like you and I, have found themselves... either having an opportunity to reevaluate how they've chosen to spend their lives, or being forced to reevaluate, time at home, on furlough, whatever. So a lot of people are saying, why did I ever become a lumberjack? I'd much rather be an accountant. So people want to go back to school and do another qualification, not necessarily back at school, but to change career, to take on new qualifications. And if you remember the first part of furlough, weren't all those adverts telling ballet dancers and opera singers to drive a taxi or train as a truck driver or something. And
that was quite controversial. Yeah.
Darcy Bustle was going, oh yeah, I'll go be a trucker. So it's all part of that. Darcy Bustle can now get money to go learn how to drive a truck. That's what this is about.
We've had some more stupid marketing come through via the PR industry, haven't we, Phil? Execrable example.
Well, I'm going to tell you about a press release I got, and I thought, this sounds interesting. I don't really understand this subject. So I thought I'd ask them. They do say there's no such thing as a stupid question. Anyway, the press release is telling me that the King's Cross development in London, this big area with involving the new King's Cross St Pancras railway station, mm-hmm. and is it Google or Facebook or one of those big offices there?
I've no idea.
I try to avoid London these days, but there's a whole area where an awful lot of building work has gone on.
2,000 homes apparently. I never thought of King's Cross as being a residential area. It's certainly changed since I used to.
2,000 homes and 4 million square feet of offices. It was probably 5 million square feet of offices, and they've changed all the offices to homes in the past year. But anyway, no, I don't think that's the case. But the point being is that the landlord of this estate, whoever that is, has signed a deal with a green energy company that they're going to have green gas. The whole of King's Cross is going to be powered by green gas. And I thought, that's interesting. Are they having to put in special pipes?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
What's great about this green gas is it will, the carbon footprint of King's Cross will be reduced. It will reduce the predicted annual carbon footprint of 31,000 tonnes by 50%. In other words, it's saving 15,500, 16,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide a year is not being released into the atmosphere.
By green gas, I mean, it's not literally green.
No, it's the same colour.
We're talking about biogas, are we?
It's the same colour, but it's biogas, yes. It's not see-through. What's the word? Clear.
It's made by sort of biodigesters, sort of sewage.
Yeah, this is gas. It's being produced by an anaerobic digestion facility.
That's the phrase. Yeah.
Old thrown away your food bin from your kitchen that goes into this big waste plant, and all that produces methane, which is different from normal methane. Normal methane is a fossil fuel that comes from things rotting away over. I don't know if it's millennia or thousands or hundreds of years.
Methane is a
finite resource, and it's bad.
It's a greenhouse
gas. Fossil fuel. Newly made methane is good because it gets rid of new kitchen waste and garden waste and whatever, and anaerobic digestion. It creates biomethane, which is exactly the same as methane. It's still CH4, but it's biomethane, and therefore it's good.
Right.
Anyway, so I said, okay, so this anaerobic digestion facility is in Scotland. So I asked the question saying, how is this methane, biomethane from the anaerobic digestion facility, how is it transported from Scotland, I asked. Do they put it in tanks so it comes down by road and then put into big storage tanks at King's Cross? And if so...
There is an old gasworks there, or used to be an old gasworks there.
Yeah, I think it's all come down. But I said, has the impact of transport been factored into the carbon savings estimate? You know, if you're given all these gas tankers driving down the motorway with all the gas that, you know, whatever it is, 8,000, 16,000 tonnes of methane. Well, that's carbon dioxide. It's more than, I don't know. Anyway, I could hear them chortling at the other end and go, isn't he stupid? Of course we wouldn't transport it by. No. It just goes to the national grid. Up in Scotland, from the anaerobic digestion, all that biomethane just goes into the national
grid. Just goes into the pipes up in Scotland.
And King's Cross takes it out the other end. So I say, sorry, I'm showing my ignorance here, but if the methane from the Scottish anaerobic digestion facility is going straight into the national grid, how doesn't it not get muddled up with all the non-biomethane that's already in the grid?
All the fossil stuff.
How can King's Cross make sure it's only taking the green stuff out and not the fossil stuff out? Well, what's actually happened, it transpires, is that King's Cross has signed a gas purchase agreement with the anaerobic digestion plant owner, has given it money, And it's a bit like, now I think about it, it's a bit like you or I don't know who supplies your gas and electricity, even if you have gas.
It's an octopus, actually. I get my gas and electricity from an octopus. Yes, a very intelligent source.
Well, I can't remember who my supplier is, I'm ashamed to say. But the gas and electricity that comes through my pipes and wires into my house is exactly the same gas and electricity that come through the pipes into your house. It's just that you give your money to person A and I give my money to person B, and we still get the same product at the end of it. So King's Cross is not being powered by biomethane. It has not reduced its carbon footprint. It is simply choosing to pay a biomethane producer as opposed to another methane producer. So may well be great that, you know, King's Cross may be doing something great, but don't try and pretend that somehow biomethane is what's powering King's Cross, because that ain't happening.
No, they're investing in renewable energy, which is great. And
are you investing in Octopus, or are you just a customer of Octopus?
I'm a customer.
Yeah, you're not investing. I think they're just a customer.
Oh, so yeah, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. Okay, then, because yes, they're going to spend that money anyway. So it's not an investment. They're just
spending it with someone who thinks a good guy.
You're right. It's the way it's presented. It's disingenuous, and in fact, it's a bit dishonest, really, isn't it? Because they're trying to paint themselves as holier than thou compared to everybody else. But they're, as you say, they're just getting the same gas out of their taps as we get out of ours.
Yeah.
They're just buying it from somebody else. And I suppose it's good that you get a big customer as a renewable energy industry. If you get a big customer like King's Cross, that's great. And I suppose that helps you invest in your own business. But really, you're the ones doing the work. The customer is simply choosing you as a deal. They might get it cheaper from them, I don't know. But I imagine that what they get out of it is the brownie points, the sort of the kudos of being able to say that they're greener than anybody else.
But I have no problem with King's Cross for choosing that supplier.
No.
I think it's a positive thing. My problem is they're spinners trying to persuade everyone that the gas that King's Cross is using is somehow different. That's what I have a problem with.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't know how many people actually fall for that. Do they really believe
that?
Hey,
I did.
Because, I mean...
Until I started...
Did you really?
I recognise. I thought, how can you just get green gas? I mean, I'd quite like... I would like it if I could, plug my computer in or my telly in or kettle on or something and say, I'll just have wind power today, please.
Yes.
Just bring some wind down my plug and leave the nukes and the coal behind. But no, that doesn't happen. It's all whatever's in the mix comes through.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that this isn't new. I mean, I can remember people saying that, you know, I'm only buying renewable energy now. And I'm talking about individuals, you know, domestic consumers. And I always thought, well, yeah, you might like to say that, but you know it's not true. It's when you get a big business really trying to pull the wool over other people's eyes. And also, I think, taking us for fools, because it doesn't take an awful lot of investigation to find out what's actually going on here. As you just asked a couple of simple questions and it all became plain. You know, it's...
I did feel slightly self-conscious knowing that I was asking really, really stupid questions. I thought, I should know this. I mean, you obviously knew already what was going on right from the get-go.
I probably would have thought that maybe, because the way it's worded makes it sound like the gas coming out of the taps anywhere within the King's Cross estate is biomethane. That's the way it is presented. That's actually what they're saying.
Yeah, and it says the deal means
the
deal means that the carbon footprint, quote, of King's Cross will be reduced by 50%. No,
yeah.
No, it doesn't mean that.
No, it doesn't mean that. No, you're quite right. Oh, I think they're even more specific than that. They say that it's, the first neighbourhood in the UK to move its entire gas supply to green gas.
Yeah.
That's a lie.
Yes.
That is essentially a lie, isn't it? Yeah. So there we are. It's a marketing industry at it again.
But they're not always bad guys, the marketing people. I came across, I came across a fabulous, fabulous bit of creative marketing. Thanks once again to those wonderful people, estate agents. And a bit of Googling tells me it's not even a new term at all. It's only new to me. But there's no one quite as creative with the use of English, it seems to me, as an estate agent. The maestros of Compact and Bijou. I got a press release through about a project starting in Coventry, a 1960s office block in Coventry city centre is being converted into flats. Now, that might be quite a tough sell, you know, municipal 60s office block. Do you want to live in that? Ooh, lovely. But hey, as we've mentioned before, the housing shortage, needs must, you know, developers will create new homes out of anything and they'll find tenants. But what struck me is that this project is going to transform a landmark mid-century building.
Oh.
Now, I'd never heard of 1960s office blocks being described as mid-century architecture before.
Sounds a lot better than 1960s.
The phrase mid-century modern is something different again, I'm led to believe. But mid-century has been around as a phrase in America for a while. But I suppose 60s architecture is less pejorative in America. But we know that post-war, so 50s, 60s architecture has not got a great image. It's not a good sales. If an estate agent is trying to sell some property saying, Georgian, Edwardian, Victorian, any of those adjectives will have them picking up the phones, queuing around the box.
Say country images, don't
any
they?
Any of those. Yeah. Tudor, Elizabethan, any of those descriptions, people will be in like flim to want to have a look at this fabulous building. 1960s, people go, oh, we might be able to afford it. That would be a good thing. We'll have a look at that. The only reason why you want a 1960s property is it can be affordable.
Yes, but you think that instead that they would, I don't know, try and conjure up the images, the image of the swinging 60s, you know, mini skirts, the Austin Mini, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, stuff like that. Maybe package it up that way. I don't know. Is the 60s fashionable these days?
I don't know. I'm not so sure. It's the 80s is the fashion at the moment in terms of that sense, isn't it?
But
I think mid-century sounds solid. I mean, the very word century, it sounds like built to last, doesn't it? Or a centurion, it's strong.
Yes, that's true.
It resonates. So that whoever came up or whoever started adopting it in the estate agent world, describing property as mid-century, You played a blinder. I think that's excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. I have come across that that usage already. Actually, quite recently, I had to clear out my parents' bungalow following their sad demise. And of course, you know, you've got to get rid of everything. You're selling a bungalow. You can't keep all their chattels and everything. So me and my sister decided that we didn't want any of their furniture, which we'd grown up with and didn't like because it was that old 1960s teak stuff, you know, Ercole and I can't remember what other makes, that kind of thing. You know, well made, good quality, but quite ugly, really. And so we decided we'd try and sell some of it on eBay, dining suite, sideboard, that kind of thing, bookshelves. And yes, I thought 1960s Ercole sideboard I put into eBay, and it was all mid-century modern. And there's a big demand for that stuff out there. We got pretty good prices for this stuff. But I think that it is partly the marketing, partly the fact that the people buying this stuff weren't even born back then. It's more appealing, more attractive. And if you describe it as mid-century modern, I don't know, that's quite a phrase that rolls off the tongue, isn't it?
My Googling seems to suggest that mid-century modern has more specific design connotations, spanning the sort of Frank Lloyd Wright to, you know, Conran Habitat type, that kind of aesthetic. Whereas just mid-century, as in age, it doesn't say anything about the design. Yeah, it's just mid-century.
Yeah. Well, good luck with selling a former office block in Coventry. You need to package that up fairly carefully, I would have thought. And I thought the whole business of, while we're on the subject, the whole business of converting former commercial premises into domestic dwellings had come in for quite a lot of flack recently. I haven't really kept an eye on that, but I know that a lot of people say that it's a charter to build rabbit hutches, you know, building tiny little flats into buildings which weren't originally built, designed to be subdivided into small packages, you know, absence of daylight, that kind of thing. So I thought that the fashion fat sort of thing was waning.
Maybe all the department stores are closing down now, so there's many more to come. But what was quite cunning about this Coventry job, which I thought was a really neat little twist on everything, because everyone now wants to work from home, and if you live in an office block, if you live in a converted office block into apartments, you know that they're going to be compact and bijou, and you're probably not going to have much space for a home office. But this is an office block being converted, so they're going to leave in this apartment office space so that you can leave your home without leaving your building and go to a communal office.
Have communal office space.
Which I think that's
brilliant.
It's clever, because there's a market for that. People... you know, they can't actually
there
work
is.
From home necessarily, everyone, for practical reasons, or sometimes for, you know, we've talked before, the psychology of needing to leave one space to go to another to become at work. But if that's in your building, you don't have to get on a train or a bus or whatever. Fabulous.
Well, I think that, yes, I think that is clever, actually. And in fact, I've noticed that there has been a fair amount of talk recently about the need to cater more for people who are working from home, if not working from home literally from their home, but as you say, working more locally. So in small sort of market towns, villages, places like that, providing, if you like, a hub so that people will be able to go into the office, but it will be a local hub, local to them rather than local to their employer, if you like. And I think that might be a market that
it's what
has
we used to call
potential.
The library. When I was at school or university,
yes,
there's
that's
too
right.
much noise going around you. You'd say, "I'm going to the library." Yeah. Didn't do any work there either, but you went to the library, maybe
yes, exactly.
feel like you're doing some work.
Yeah, well, yes, I think it's exactly that. And so, if you're going to use, I mean, instead of working from a home office, I suppose these people in Coventry are going to be working from an office home, aren't they?
Have you got anything else to talk about, David?
No, I think we've covered all the main points.
I've still not got hold of Rod Stewart, I'm afraid.
No. Well, are you going to keep on trying?
I will. We share a birthday, Rod and I.
Oh, really? Oh, excellent.
Not the same year, only the same day, a month. But yeah.
Well, I'm sure that once you reveal that, you'll be down there straight away.
Oh, he knows that. He knows that. Yeah. He'll have read about that before, I'm sure.
Oh, well.
Right.
We live in hope.
Are we wrapping up?
I think we are. Yeah, I think that's about it. We could carry on talking, but it would be drivel.
Well, thank you, everyone, once again, for listening to Reconstruction. But for another week, that's it. That's your lot. I've been Phil Bishop, and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.